All right, I'm going to give this my best try. And good day, nerds. Welcome to another Cantina Conversation. This week we have the author PJ Manny, who is a futurist who wrote the Phoenix Horizon trilogy. This week to talk about her final installment in the trilogy that Megan McCarthy Bianc just recently did a review on. I myself, Steve, joined this conversation due to the intense conversation of future technology, AI, NFTs, blockchains, everything we talk about on our news show. So I was invited to join this conversation. It was a really fun conversation to have about future tech and how our world right now can lead into this future world that she laid out in her stories. So with that said, let's get to the interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, so we've got PJ Manny here, author of the Phoenix Horizon trilogy. Revolution came out, in 2015?
Correct.
Identity came out a couple years ago. Was it 2019?
2017.
2017, okay. And then Conscience came out last month, right? I got
Correct.
It right? Okay,
yep.
Awesome. Thanks for making time to talk to us today. We've also got Steve here, co-founder, co-host of the Nerd Cantina show, to talk about some of the nerd tech side of things. So thank you for rolling with the punches here.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Okay, so yeah, we'll get started like with your background. This trilogy is really like, you know, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence. It gets really deep and you kind of like take it, you know, so much further than maybe, I might have not even gone there, but, you know, you go pretty deep and you go into detail. So yeah, go to like what your background and like kind of how, you know, you came up with the story, like the type of research that you went into it and all that good stuff.
Okay, great. So I'm not a scientist.
Really?
I come actually out of Hollywood. I worked as a movie executive and wrote television, Xena Warrior Princess and Hercules Legendary Journeys. And
boom.
Wrote a ton of pilot scripts, sold a bunch. None of them got made.
Oh.
And at a really depressing meeting at a network where we were actually bringing in another writer's work. And we realized that the executives didn't know what Antarctica was.
Okay.
I kind of had a moment of, you know, I'm done.
Is that some new hard seltzer that they're selling now?
Yeah, you know, literally took my husband saying, you know, and this gives you an idea how many years ago, March of the Penguins. And, you know, after you're like sank on into the bottom of the world. And anyway. So I had a story that I had originally set as a possible TV series, which was Revolution, and no one bought it. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to write the novel. And mm-hmm. I'd never written a novel. In fact, I'd been told my entire school education that I should never be a writer.
Oh my goodness.
I'm dyslexic. I'm dysgraphic. I'm dyscalculic. And I have ADHD on top of all of that. The feeling back then was if you can't spell and you have terrible grammar and bad usage, don't become a writer, not realizing that actually dyslexia is a superpower for writing, especially just for sheer storytelling.
I've watched a few documentaries on dyslexia. I think I'm part dyslexic myself. I have a lot of the symptoms. And that's what they say is that it's actually a life building tool that helps you learn how to work around what most people nowadays see as a straight line. You're used to having to weave in and out of normal teachings, normal curriculum, and figure it out for yourself.
Exactly. And what's really interesting in terms of storytelling is that we're not linear thinkers at all. What we are structural thinkers. So I have friends who think of stories as trees or Lego sets. I think of them as roller coasters, like a physical three-dimensional roller coaster. And because we're really good spatially, that's dyslexia, the compensation is spatial. So I thought of stories, you know, I can build a story. And that was something that I didn't realize was hard for people. So I taught myself how to write prose. I've been already writing screenplays, which are all structure.
Mm-hmm,
literally all, especially television, is completely structural. So I taught myself how to write prose on Revolution, sold that. They bought the next two novels and wrote those. So it was a long process. I had to do a lot of research. I've always been a neuroscience geek, always. And when I was, I went to summer school when I was 17 at a place called the New School for Social Research. It's a college in New York City. And I took a class in human behavioral psychology. It was amazing. It was taught by a very, very young Robert Sapolsky, who's now one of the most famous behavioralists in the world today. And he was, he was in his early 20s, and he was illegally moonlighting teaching classes there.
Going to bootleg college classes. That's new.
It was great. I mean, thank God my college took the credits. There's actually part of the dyslexia thing. I couldn't take math and science at my college because it was so hardcore and serious and you know, the math. So he turned me on to brains. Just completely and utterly became fascinated with it, always kept up with what was going on. And when I decided I was looking for the MacGuffin, if you will, the technology that was going to really drive these stories, it became obvious that it had to be neuroscience. So brain-computer interfaces were just being theorized at the time. And that I thought was incredibly exciting because to me, immediately the ethics, the weaponization, the medical therapeutic applications, all of it just was like, it was obvious. That one of the things I try to explain to people as a futurist is that technology is morally neutral. It's what we do with it that matters. So you've got swords, you've got plowshares. It's the same, you know, metal stick.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes for all the technologies I cover in the book. So I got really deep in it. I was going to conferences. I was talking to scientists and technologists. A lot of these people became friends. And it became something that, you know, I have an expertise in now.
Yeah.
With your background in psychology, just real quick, because we talk about it on the show quite often, free will or determinism?
Neither.
Ooh. Okay. Okay.
Neither. I don't believe in free will because we're such biological creatures run by our hormones, and our hormones are affected by everything environmental, everything personal. And it's definitely not determinism because there are far too many variables.
Yeah. Me and my brother actually did a specific episode just on free will and determinism, and he falls in the same that I might have the illusion of choice, but at least I have that illusion of choice.
Right. And hey, the illusion of choice is great. as long as you don't take it too seriously.
So yeah, we talk a lot about these things on our new show every week. Neuralink is probably in our monthly, you know, every month they come out with something new about it. We have three sections of our podcast. It's usually entertainment, tech, and then space. And the tech is usually filled with something on the blockchain, something with interfacing your brain into computers, or basically how Google and Facebook run our lives.
I certainly cover the blockchain, and I certainly cover brain computer interfaces.
Yeah.
It's funny. I actually avoid social media as social media, like as Facebook, as branded content in my books, because I think that, you know, they're going to evolve into something else.
Mm. Oh, for sure. If you mention them, you're essentially time stamping your work.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of did like gloss over it in this story, just kind of like something to consider because, you know, you're like, oh, can you imagine how it is now type of thing with all the social media? And that's like the extent that she went into in her books was just, it exists and it is in that environment, in that world. But yeah, you didn't really pay much attention to it other than that it exists. But, yeah. And that's like kind of, cause I mean, you kind of like with your little intro that, Brianna was sending to me was that you being a futurist was that you had like almost like predicted the Neuralink and you kind of, you almost like predicted like that NFTs were going to become a thing. I still don't really get the, like, I have still trying to wrap my head around what NFTs are. I listen to the podcast.
I own a few. I
listen to the podcast every week and I try my best to like understand what they're talking, but though I kind of get it, but I just to like kind of see it coming. That's like on a whole nother level.
Well, the funniest part about the NFTs was, in theory, I probably made one of the very first ones about 6 years ago. A friend of mine who's an artist in the UK named Russell Ruckin said, hey, there's this thing, the blockchain. You're writing about it. Why don't
it's
we?
Not have- a rap group. It's an actual thing.
Right? No. I was already writing about it. I mean, you know, this was not something I was unaware of by any means. He said, "Why don't you make the first digital autograph for a digital book? We'll do both the physical autograph on a physical book and the digital autograph. We'll replicate it in a digital book. And actually, it's actually inside of his Kindle. Like I was able to upload a file into his Kindle, which had never existed before. And we were the very first people to put on the blockchain. So I actually am the very first author.
So are you going to mint the trilogy and put it as an NFT?
So what we're going to do, actually, I'm now working with Russell. He's got a company called Datamex in the UK, and we're putting together basically an art project. I'm really just the subject with the books. He and a bunch of artists, different kinds of visual and data artists, are putting together this whole project. It's fantastic. And it will be one for each of the books. And it'll be inspired by, you know, their thoughts of the books. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's crazy.
well, with your futurist background, you know, calling these things before and seeing it now, I joke about on the podcast a lot that what's happening in the world now is kind of like every 1980s conspiracy theorist sweat dream. Like they're putting microchips in your brain, man. It's gonna like everybody who had these wild ideas back in the 80s. Now it's 2020s and
Let's really go there. If, you know, Philip K. Dick had those ideas before anybody. and he was in the 50s and 60s. And in the 80s, they were reading Philip K. Dick and having their heads explode. But yes, this is what's so interesting is technology is moving ahead really quickly to the extent that we can actually see it and feel it, which previous generations, yeah, my grandmother watched from a horse and carriage to a car, or from Orville and Wilbur Wright to the Concorde. But this is a whole nother evolution of technology, and we're right now in this big paradigm shift period, which is what I'm really trying to talk about in the stories.
Yeah, I've often said that it feels like we're in the next, you know, in the early 80s and late 80s was the time where if you invested in companies like Apple and Microsoft, it was like the ground floor and you were kind of in the know. And now it feels like it's almost the next generation's it's that time for them with NFTs and crypto and everything that's kind of coming out now. It feels like we're at like a new ground floor with technology, and that everything is kind of becoming new, and you can see the future on the horizon for the people like us that keep in the know and things like that. I feel like we're really in like a new renaissance of technology.
We are, and no question. And there are two ways of looking at it. One is like with NFTs. NFTs are really a response to what do you do when everything digital is supposed to be free? Mm. How do artists make money from digital work that is easily pirated, easily reproduced? And NFTs became the blockchain's response to being able to authenticate and own something that's unique. Now, I grew up in the art world and antique world, and I literally grew up in auction houses and in art galleries and museums. And the entire art market is based on rarity and provenance. Who owned it and how many of them are there and how important is it? And that's what the NFTs are responding to. Mm-hmm. How can we create the same kind of market scarcity for a digital asset? So I get it. I understand why people think they should exist. Now, I will also say that the crazy prices being generated right now,
you don't own a Beeple? Like, what do you do? You don't own one? Get with it.
here's the problem. Like the real art market, it's often used for money laundering and market manipulation and a whole variety of very unsavory things. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the art is bad or that people shouldn't pay good money for good art. But the prices that we've been seeing are more about them trying to establish a market and manipulate it, my mm-hmm. personal opinion, sending money to themselves, in essence. There's a lot of money just going in a big circle right now, trying to get people excited about a new product. So once that all settles down, I mean, think of it like this. It was the Renaissance, right? And the Medici family and the great families of the Italian city-states are all paying crazy money for, you know, I want to own Da Vinci, or I want to own Michelangelo. Like, they owned these guys. They were patrons. They put a great deal of money and effort into making these artists' careers and putting them in great places. That's a little bit of what's happening right now, is we're watching the sense of scarcity to build a market, and it's all going to settle down.
I do see it giving people more power as we move forward with the NFTs, and you now tie them to concert tickets and plays, and to where now, you know, my true hope is that one day I will live in a Ticketmaster free world where I can just buy my concert ticket from the band. And if I have to scalp it, I know that my overpaying for that ticket is at least supporting the artist who I'm going to see at some point, not just going to the hands of crazy tech guys with bots that know how to buy tickets, or scalpers, or somebody with an in. You know, you're going to see venues and artists actually selling their own tickets and profiting on the 3, 4, 5 times it's resold, and actually being able to profit, through their art better.
There are a lot of media companies that are looking at NFTs as the killer app for the blockchain for them, that it's not actually about the money in the sense of it's not about crypto. It's about the ability to control distribution, once again, of a digital asset. So there are a lot of media companies and sporting companies that are looking at this stuff. And I get it. I understand why.
I have friends that work for Marvel, and right now Marvel's scrambling to figure it out, because as everybody wants to just draw an Iron Man NFT and mint it and put it out there, you know, they're sending cease and desist letters out like crazy. It's very much the Wild West right now in this kind of technology. Where do you feel regulation falls into any of this, or do you feel that it needs any at all?
Well, certainly crypto is going to need regulation.
There's a lot of Dogecoin holders that really hate Elon Musk right now.
Yeah. And I even use the term in terms and conscience. I mean, there's so much pump and dump going on right now that there's going to end up being some kind of regulation. The other thing you have to understand is how many countries are now going to start issuing their own crypto, which will eventually replace.
Or also ban it. India and China have also banned crypto altogether.
They're not banning crypto. They're banning Bitcoin. They want their own crypto. They're banning Bitcoin and allowing and basically telling all the miners, yeah, so we're going to have you guys start working on ours. And the reason for that is because it's really easy for a government to create a currency that's digital with an open back door to them, where they can know every transaction. You might be able to hide it from everybody else, but they're not, you can't hide it from them. And that's exactly what China wants. That's what Russia wants.
Yep.
They're all developing their own national cryptos because of this. The United States will be doing it too. Don't kid yourself. We actually have at least one financial chairperson of a U.S. government regulator who actually understands crypto. I know one off the top of my head.
I was going to say, one is a very small number given the fact of how prevalent this is.
But he is the head of his very large regulatory body. So they're already having the conversations.
Yeah, I don't have too much faith in our country ramping this up as we keep electing 80-year-olds to head of office.
This is why you have somebody who actually runs a regulatory commission who does understand it. So the head of the SEC, Gary Gensler, was the professor at MIT's Sloan Business School who taught the famous crypto and Bitcoin class, along with Larry Lessig, who would sit in the back of the class and then kibitz and say, hey, did you talk about this? And hey, I had an idea about that. So between Larry Lessig and Gary Gensler, you had, and the grad students at MIT, you had a very fertile ground for coming up with very smart ideas. Gary's now the head of the SEC. So with Gensler at the head of it, I can promise you that they're not going to go in blind, which is good.
This is good. So you had touched,
somebody who understands what's going on.
you had touched earlier on the fact that, you know, technology is technology and it's what we do with it that makes it good or evil. And Megan can more attest to this in your stories. How, as an author, do you like playing with those? Because you find that most sci-fi or, you know, writing, TV, they like to play with the evil. No one's really writing stories of this utopian world where technology just benefits humanity in this great way. Do you find that you need to have a balance, or do you just like playing with the evil toys and running with it?
Well, you also have to remember it's about the mindset you're in when you're writing these things. So when I wrote Revolution, I was enjoying the evil toys. I do think that in many ways, science fiction is about the cautionary tale, and it's what creates the drama, that you can create a scenario. Let me back up one second. To be a futurist is to think in scenarios. And if you're a professional futurist, and a company hires you and says, hey, what's going to happen with Bitcoin? Your job is to give them a variety of scenarios. The best case, the worst case, and
the most likely case.
The most likely. And also just the middle cases. Because, you know, let's see. And it's not even just the most likely. You don't know which one it is. There are too many variables. But looking at general trends and looking at data, you can get a sense of where things are going. So if I'm looking at a story and I want to create a very dramatic story, I'm going to look at the worst case scenario, right? Having said that, one of the big projects that I've been working on recently with a lot of science fiction and fantasy writers and general communicators is this group called the New Mythos. I basically had an epiphany in the middle of a science fiction convention, NorwestCon, in 2018 after I had released Identity. And I had one of these epiphanies on the panel in a group called Science Fiction in the Age of Trump, where we were trying to figure out, what does it look like now? How does it change?
And it's huge.
So one of the things that sort of had this epiphany was, again, this was a number of years ago, that we have all these young people reading fantasy and science fiction that is very dystopic. And in some cases, with really sad endings. I mean, you know, they're not even like the last minute happy endings. Some of them are like, and everyone dies. We have a lot of young people who are reading stories where they're told what's wrong, but they're not told how to fix it. And I thought that was a problem because it's a problem in the myths that we tell in general Western storytelling, because we have this, you know, Western storytelling structure where it's supposed to be trial after trial after trial, and it's horrible. And then we climax, it's over, as opposed to building a more utopic, or at least here's our issue, here's our struggle. And as a community, we come together. It's not about the chosen one. all of these different aspects of what we consider classic Western Joseph Campbell hero's journey storytelling that might not be preparing us for real conflict or real tragedy or real struggles. And especially, I mean, look at comic books are the perfect example. I love them, but they always are about they're always about returning to the status quo. But that's not reality. That's not how the world works. You know, if anything, I wrote my books as an answer to, you're never going back to the status quo. Technology is changing everything. And here we go. Hang on.
Yeah. If COVID has taught us anything.
Right. Yeah. The world changes. So if that's the case, then one of the reasons to tell these kinds of stories is to not just tell a truer story. Not that the bad stuff is going to happen, but the fact that things have to change. That's the truth. But with a new mythos, thinking of new ways to tell stories that really are relevant to today, to where we're going as a species, I think that's super important. And I discovered it in the middle of writing this trilogy. And so I know my third book, people are going to go, wait, what?
Yeah, I did, you know.
Yeah, as a reader, like how do you pick up on it? Like, you know, you seem to have a very balanced view of the future with the positive and negative and how we can manage and navigate through them both. As a reader, when you read these things, is it hard to, once you see the doomsday, is it hard to see the utopia?
You asking me or her?
Yeah.
Okay.
You.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, I mean, she's very good at, very descriptive, and it helped me like understand a lot of concepts that I didn't really have never really approached or at least kind of just like heard about. And, but you know, I really enjoy how, Steve, I appreciate that you asked, okay, you know, good versus evil. Like, how are you going to use that technology? Like, which way should you go? Cause you did that like right in the first book, where it's like the nanobots, where you see like, this is such a revolutionary thing. And then you see him, you know, his technology, it's not a spoiler. His technology gets stolen and it's used to kill hundreds of thousands of people. And then, you know, throughout that whole first book, he's trying to get to the bottom of it. And then once it's finally revealed, like what happened and that it's going to happen again, but like in a more like almost a scarier way, like they're going to use the nanobots to basically, I don't know what the correct term is, like to numb the population, like the global population, so that the people, the elite, the people in charge could just keep doing what they're doing without being questioned, without being challenged. And then the people will just be like numb and unquestioning and just like happy. Like, oh, they don't know that we're doing them a favor. And then when the main character sees it, like his technology being used for this, he's like, oh, hell no. And then, it's like how you're, also, when you said like, oh, it's a community thing, like there's not a chosen one, you did kind of keep bringing that up, because it is Peter slash Tom slash
right.
Peter Tom oh, slash, right. You know, to catch you up to speed, Steve, the main character gets uploaded into a server, becomes the first artificial human intelligence, which was like each book she took it a step further. And I was like, okay, like I was able to grasp around. So like to answer your question, yeah, like as a reader, I got the gist of it. And it also was like, oh, like this is where it could go. Like this is like an interesting take on and very scary, you know, frighteningly realistic way that it could be used. And well, there's yeah, a lot of like
talk
political
a lot now.
And like parallels and like politically and all that. And like the global, like the head honchos, like Russia and China, like how would their involvement, you know? And so that's like when you mention these things, it's like, well, damn, like there's just like so much that I don't know. And now it's like it is relevant. It's so relevant. Like, and it's telling too. It's like, oh, okay. Like this is very possible. How far could it go? How far should we go? Just because we can do it, should we? And then there's like a whole bunch of like other implications. Like how is like increasing technology, like teaching us empathy? Cause you dive into that. Once he becomes a server, he's not able to like really relate to humanity, but he has to help them. And it's like, it just go like, there was just so many, like, this went into so many ways and you found a way to like kind of keep it all together, even though I had to try to keep track of how many versions of him there were out there.
Oh, but, tell me about it. Trust me, writing it was hilarious as well. But yes, you did a great job. Thank you, Maggie.
Oh, sure.
Well, we often, you know, with our new show, we talk about all the hacking stories and the AI stuff. And I often feel like a lot of these modern coders now are almost like mini Oppenheimers, right? Like we create a nuclear fission. We could either power the world, but instead we blew a bunch of shit up and killed off a lot of humanity. It's, you know, I feel with coding and way the technology is going is that we have a good handful of mini Oppenheimers out here creating technology. Like, we do a lot of stories on deepfakes and how that's going to affect society in the future and stuff like that. And yeah, like as you say in your books, like we can use these tools to do a lot of good, but I think we all know where human nature tends to point us. And
the funny part is that the way human nature works is it's actually a relatively small percentage of people who are doing really unfortunate things. But there are enough of them. There are enough of them to affect society. Whereas you have a whole bunch of people who are tech savvy, who are doing good things, but they have a hard time imagining people doing bad things with their work. That's a real true psychology of scientists and technologists. Or they're so eager to do the right thing with it, they just literally are la 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 la. You know, they don't want to know. And when I was first doing the original research with Revolution on brain computer interfaces, oh my goodness, no one wanted to talk to me.
No.
I said, yeah, I'm reading the story, and they were like, oh, nope, because all of their grants are about, you know, curing depression, curing Alzheimer's, curing Parkinson's, curing epilepsy, you know, they didn't want to hear the other things that could be done with it. But of course, then you get someone like Elon Musk, who often says the thing he's thinking.
Yeah, we're big Lex Friedman fans, and you know, a lot of these guys that they have no problem pitching the doomsday scenario.
Right, exactly. And I have a kind of weird relationship with the whole Neuralink thing, in that one of the issues that everyone talks about with Neuralink, the present one, which they put into the pigs, is that it's really older technology. He hasn't done anything that wasn't theorized back in the 2000s, which is why I use that technology, because I read the same papers he did. And so my brain computer interface is Neuralink. But I wrote it in the early teens. It came out in 2015. He created Neuralink in 2017 and then just started going, oh my God, you know, how can we build these things? And I thought it was a coincidence of just that was technology and research that was out there at the time. And then I heard one of his PR promotions at the very beginning of Neuralink, and I was listening to it going, God, that sounds familiar. And realized that they were sections of the pitch that were in my book. So that's one of those great situations where science fiction influences technologists, and then technologists influence science. You know, so this fabulous feedback loop of
yeah, you watch a lot of technology. Old 70s sci-fi, and you can tell that a lot of the modern tech was influenced by shows like Star Trek, and
totally,
you know, you just see that it's almost like a weird form of Inception. Some sci-fi writer just has this crazy idea, then a generation of people grow up watching or reading about this and think, why can't we do it? And then in two generations it's here, and we have monkeys playing Pong, and I'm trying to, we have an active hashtag trying to get that monkey on Twitch so we can watch monkeys play Pong.
That's exactly right. And so it is kind of freaky. So back to the, you know, if you do enough research, the coming up with what's coming, you know, the predicting of the future isn't that hard. I guess it's why what I do is basically futurism, because you can see what the R&D is. You can read the papers. You can see where it's going, and it just takes time. So what I do is I extrapolate out, well, what's that going to actually look like? Could that look like in society given certain parameters? And but there were some things that did come true that were kind of weird. So, you know, like writing about an American businessman who was being corrupted by Russian interference. They decided to make president. So there were things where I was like, oh,
yeah.
Pick that one up out of the ether or what?
Well, I often talk a lot about how the future of NFTs, I believe, is also highly tied to VR, you know, so your character is stuck in a server. And I truly believe that in the next 5 to 10 years, with Oculus becoming very popular, the PlayStation VR becoming very popular, I'm going to be able to send somebody an invite on my PlayStation to my digital gallery, and we will be able to digitally walk through my curated art gallery where I show them all my statue NFTs and art NFTs. And I really can I think it's like almost a non-brainer that that's where this is going, especially with how much the younger generation is into things like AR and VR and into this kind of tech, that if you're trying to fight it, you're fighting a losing battle. Like, it's just, you know, it's inevitable at this point.
So then the question becomes, how do we as a society try to do it right? And make sure that the powers of good prevail. You know, we're going to do it. So let's do it in a way that's fair and non-destructive and not exploitive, mm-hmm. and all of those things. And yeah, that's much easier said than done. But if we don't start thinking about it, we've already seen the scam artists rush in to crypto, into NFT, into all this stuff. I mean, the idealism wasn't even off the bloom yet. And suddenly, you know, people saw what was possible.
Yeah, we just did a story this week on the Charlie Bit My Finger YouTube video, got minted as an NFT and sold for $800,000.
And then taken off of YouTube.
And then the guy that bought it, yeah, took it off YouTube just so that nobody could ever, he would never be pestered with that video ever again. but you do see this like rush to the technology with every celebrity trying to cash in on not the NFT, but the fame mixed with the NFT, just so that, you know, as soon as Beeple sold that $60 million NFT, you had Snoop Dogg and Halsey and Elon Musk's wife and all these people just rushed to mint anything that had their name on it, because you're not buying into the tech. You're not even really buying the art. You're buying this trend.
Yeah. Purely provenance. I own the only thing of this from Snoop Dogg, or I own an edition of five, you know, one of five. And that's, you know what it is? It's like buying John F. Kennedy's ballpoint pen he signed, you know, whatever treaty with. The pen is meaningless. It's the fact that JFK signed the treaty with this pen. Mm-hmm. And those things have value. I mean, that's the bottom line. They're attached to someone famous. They have value.
Yeah, we had said it. So, Megan, you said you weren't like really kind of getting the NFT thing. It's, you know, the way Ken explained it on the show is you could have a poster of the Mona Lisa up in your room. Nobody's stopping you. But everybody knows that's not the Mona Lisa. And it's right. And you can have just a screenshot of an NFT if you want on your computer as a wallpaper. But as NFTs grow and the fame that comes with artists and whatnot, people will know. Yeah, you have a picture of that NFT, but you don't own the NFT itself. It's more, you know, it's the same thing, but digital form.
You don't even really own the NFT. And that's the real bottom line is you're in essence holding a placeholder for the NFT. That's what the token is.
Okay. And I think I understand it up to that point. I was like, wait. Like a placeholder.
You technically own a percentage. You own a small percentage. No matter what the creator will own, you know, I think most creators are labeling like 10-15%. So that anytime if I bought, you know, PJ's NFT and you wanted to buy it from me, I could sell it to you, but then whatever I sell it to you for, PJ would get whatever percentage mm-hmm. that she deemed for the rest of her life.
That's the interesting aspect of NFTs from a creative standpoint, because so many times a creator sells their work for not a lot of money. And it isn't until much later, it's worth a lot. And it's only being sold between owners and collectors for great deals of money. And the artist is like, I sold it for my painting for $1,000 and it's now $100,000. And they never see a piece of it. So this is actually like a royalty system.
Right.
You know, I get it. Again, whether you like it or not, whether you think it's valid or not, it kind of doesn't matter.
Yeah, we did a story this week on a comic company sold Michael Turner's most famous cover for, I think, $100,000 as an NFT. And that was my question. Did his estate get a portion of that minted NFT? Because if not, then my big fear is that every comic company and a lot of these people are going to mint deceased artists' work that don't have really a claim to it, because their estate isn't either into NFTs or, you know, they're gonna jump on it. Yeah, they're just gonna jump on it. So that was my big thing is image sold Michael Turner's cover for an NFT. He died of cancer, I think 9 years ago. And does his children get any of that, or his children minted on it?
And who knows? It depends on the smart contract that's created for the NFT.
Yeah. So I'm wondering what's going to happen to, you know, famous artists who have just maybe recently passed. Like you said, they sold their work for cheap, but we all know as an artist passes away, their art accumulates in value. Is there going to be this big cash grab now with NFTs trying to?
What about copyright? Now we have a whole nother issue with.
That's why I asked, how do you enforce this? What entity enforces someone stole my NFT? You know, YouTube has a system, you know, to flag anytime you use Cardi B's song in your dance video, you know, but who's gonna go after the kid that took my NFT and made it his computer background? You know what I mean? Nobody.
I can guarantee you that's gonna happen. You know, this is one of the things about the entire crypto world in general. I thought it was hilarious, and one of the reasons I wrote these stories, I thought it was hilarious at the beginning of crypto when they said, oh, unbreakable, unhackable, unstealable. The safest technology in the world. And of course it's not.
There's nothing in the technology world. It's only a matter of time.
Nothing. Exactly. And this is, and they'd be like, no, it's too hard to bother. And I'm like, right now, a year from now, it won't be.
Time and pressure will break anything.
Yeah. That's it. And you know, and it's all about what are the stakes? If the stakes are high enough, forget about it. It's toast.
Well, that was always my argument against Apple computers. They would always say, Apple computers, we don't get viruses and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, no, you're only 5% of the market share. No one's bothering making a virus that only applies to 5% of the computers. They're going after the big money. They're going after Windows. You're not extra safe. You're just small fry.
Exactly right. So, you know, and my favorite was, there's no such thing as a 51% attack. It's all theoretical. And then, of course, they're 51% attack. And so I write about that in my stories, is that now they're easy, you know, in this future. And I don't even address quantum computing.
I'm glad you didn't, though, because there was enough to wrap my head around. Honestly.
I had a big get with the screenplay of Devs when Devs came out for the con. We did a big thing on that, and that's just a whole, you once you start unwrapping that, that's a whole nother trilogy.
Right. Yeah, totally. that's exactly it. And I didn't want to go there. And so there's definitely a certain amount of programming hand waving. So
is that maybe your next project? Like if you're going to think about working on something in the future?
Well, it's definitely, I'm working on a series of linked short stories, kind of like Cloud Atlas in the sense of, it'll all take place in the same time period as opposed to Cloud Atlas, which is through time. But, I want to examine where we're going, a little further out. Because these folks are all, in theory, a few years ahead, you know, they're all like, they start 5 years ahead if wherever we are.
Right.
and then it's another 2 years and 3 years. And I definitely want to address quantum computing at some point. But I also want to talk about climate change and a whole host of different things that are happening out there. Where I see big change happening.
So like with your, you're just off the back of, you know, finalized your trilogy. Are you more confident now writing prose, like, you know, from TV screenwriting to literature, novels, and like you're ready to tackle on everything else now?
A lot of words. Yeah. I'm more confident writing prose. In fact, I just wrote and sold my first short story. A friend of mine is putting together a ghost story anthology called December Tales. It's being edited by J.D. Horn, who's a very well-known horror and fantasy writer. And because I have a lot to say about ghost stories, I actually grew up in the town where the American Ghost Story was created. And my house was actually haunted as a kid. Old house, and there was all kinds of stuff that went on there. So, so I wrote a very embroidered version of that place and that time. And, so I taught myself how to write short, but that took months to, you know, practice and classes with Kat Rambo and other people. And, so yeah, I'd like to write short for a while. Writing big, gnarly trilogies.
So coming from a Hollywood background, once you started writing your books, did you find it to be a more kind of freeing experience? I know Hollywood is very regimented, you know, you
there's
like
more
you said
cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, and, you have a boardroom of people you have to appease, so you're really you're writing in like the bumper bowling lane. They're not going to let you go outside the gutters at all. Like how did it feel to pull the bumpers, throw a couple gutter balls?
Well, I learned some very important lessons. The first lesson was, well, I literally describe writing Revolution and feeling like I had ripped off my corset and spread out, you know, because, you know, I was like, I can write anything. Oh my God. And then I learned the lesson of writing prose, which is, you know, it's really not that different from writing any other form of storytelling. So what was a much longer story got pulled in a lot and edited down quite a bit. So that was a huge lesson. Stephen Barnes, who's a wonderful science fiction writer as well as television writer along with his wife, Tanana Reeve-Douay, he actually writes his novels as a screenplay first. And really, he's doing like something between an outline and a screenplay, because he knows if he can get that down, it's a tight, tight story.
Circling back to your experience of switching, and you already did touch upon like your lessons learned and stuff of like going from screenwriting to prose and writing your novels and like your plans for the future. So it's like, what were your favorite parts to write? Or parts of the writing process of making this transition, and like, what were your least favorite? Like, what were you not a fan of?
I really enjoy writing the tear jerky moments.
With his son, or because I
with his son, or with some previous lovers, etc.
Yeah,
things happen. I don't know why. I just enjoy writing those. I shouldn't enjoy them as much as I do.
No, a lot of authors, like, you know, when I ask this question a lot, like, what were your favorite parts to write? And they say, well, I like it when I can get gory, or I like it when I can make bad things happen to my characters. It's like, it's fun to just like throw things out there.
I love really getting into the hardcore emotional stuff. That's great. And if I can make myself cry, win.
Is that the brain psychologist classes in you, or is that having to do so much tech research that you're just hungering for human emotion?
I think it's, you know what it is? I think it's like, if I can make myself cry, I've tapped into something really fundamental, and I certainly have an emotional relationship with all of these characters. I have favorite characters. I have, you know,
who's your favorite?
Ruth.
Mine too. She kept it going for me.
So as an author, when you declare a favorite character, do you write with bias?
I don't know. I hope I don't write with bias. I try to love all my children the same. Yeah,
that's a determinist talking. Right. I don't know.
But I do think that I think I loved Ruth because I got to mine some of my own personal background in. I've talked about this in other places. So I'm Jewish. My parents spoke a little Yiddish. My grandparents spoke Yiddish, and Yiddish for me was the secret language. It's what they, when they would talk about sex and money and scandal, that's what the language they would speak to each other in, so that little Patricia couldn't hear anything. So learning Yiddish for Ruth was really fun. And I discovered just what kind of a potty mouth my grandmother had, which was really shocking. But that's also the nature of Yiddish. It's very scatological. It's very earthy. And it's a very real, very honest language.
Yeah.
So that was fun. And she really does get to be Ruth, with the Yiddish, the conscience of the story. I mean, she is the heart and soul and conscience of the story that keeps all the Peters and Toms and everybody on track, because they are very fallible characters and have real issues. And I didn't want heroic heroes. I wanted heroes who were really like, wow, I'm a hero in spite of myself. Mm. And that was an experiment for me. I like difficult heroes. So I needed somebody who, with all of her own issues, kept the heartbeat going and kept everybody doing the right thing. Mm. And yeah, that's the, you know, so it wasn't the hero in this case. It was a protagonist, but not the protagonist.
Yeah. And I appreciate that she was like, you know, she was a childhood friend. She could keep up with them, if not so more than like, because she was just as smart, just as accomplished, just as like, she could hold her own amongst these like crazy brains. But then also, you know, she had her issues too, but it was like, I just loved how she could hold her own. But then she was at the same time, she was like, she's like, you're being a dumbass right now. Like, are you kidding me? Like, how could you not see this? And how could you like, I appreciated her too. She was my favorite as well. I was like, I was glad that she made it. And then glad that at the end, he was like, no, keeping Ruth happy is the most important thing. And I'm like, yeah, it's true. It's true. Because they were like just so close in their projects, and they started to everything that Peter was going through started to affect her. It started to affect her work, which affected his work and everything that they were trying to do. And so I just thought it was really important. So one last thing, you said this was originally going to be like, for the small screen for TV, right? I think you said that before you originally wrote it so did you have actors in mind to play these certain characters? Cause I'm curious about that as well.
Oh, gosh.
You know you do.
I'm like, come on. I know you've given it some thought.
You know you do.
The problem is that I started it so long ago. All these actors are now too old to play these roles. Oh, no. If you don't think I wasn't thinking of it, you're crazy.
You probably don't know the TikTok star who's going to play your main character right now.
Exactly. They're not born yet. They're on TikTok in high school right now. like Doctor Who, I always saw as Octavia Spencer, whom I adore. I think she's an amazing actress. Honestly, Carter was definitely like a Brad Pitt meets, you know.
I got that vibe.
But I didn't write them with actors in mind. And part of that I think is screenplay training, because you don't want to write a screenplay with anybody in particular in mind, unless you are hired by that person to write them a script.
Yeah. You never know if they're going to take the project or anything.
It could be next year. It could be 10 years from now. It could be who knows who the actor is who's going to play it. So you don't want to be too specific. So that was probably the best way to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because it's like you don't know if they're even going to take it if something comes up, and then it's like you it's so hard to like see anybody else in a role that you wrote for someone else. It's like, and then there goes your story. It's like, what are you gonna do now? Yeah, but so we can wrap up now.
I got one last quick question.
Go for it.
Because it's coming in the next 5 to 8 years, roughly. We'll both still be here with plenty of time. Are you getting Neuralink?
No, I'm not, because...
deaf and blind and Neuralink can cure it. You go in Neuralink.
Okay, if I'm deaf and blind... Maybe.
You still got to think about it. You still got to think about it even.
Problem. Here's my problem. If we can't stop the Colonial Pipeline from being ransomware attacked, if we can't stop every computer that has an internet interface from attack, how the hell are we going to keep from attack the stuff
from our own brains. I know. I feel you.
I write about that in the story. You know, it's like these are minds under attack. And how do you stop that? I don't know how you do it. And the tragedy to me is that there are so many therapeutic uses for these brain computer interfaces. It's ridiculous. I mean, my mother-in-law has Alzheimer's. My father-in-law and both my parents have dementia. I'm looking down the barrel of, you know, years of taking care of people with cognitive diseases. There's a reason I wrote about trying to cure cognitive diseases, because it's a very personal story.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to guarantee that these technologies are protected. And given the present corporate structures of the companies that are developing these, I can't guarantee that yet.
Nope.
I just want to open my garage door like a Jedi. I mean, is that too much to ask? I mean, it's the future, right? It's the future.
I don't even have a smart house. I don't have a Nest. I don't have a Ring. I don't have an Alexa. I don't have anything that isn't like, you know, use your hands to raise your wind, you know,
we talk about these horrors. We talk about the hacks and the horrible things that could come from tech every week. And we also joke about that. We're just cogs in the wheel too. I have Google all over my house. I have the Nest thermostat. I have an iPhone. I know they're all listening to me. I want my data money. We get it. I totally get it. Kudos to you if you can stay off the grid. I fight it. It's a thing that I have an internal struggle with.
My giant iMac. So, you know, it's not exactly, you know, living the prepper survivalist dream over here.
And we all got to get by, right? We all got to get by. It's a digital world and we got to eat.
Exactly. Thank you so much, PJ. All right. So all three books, we've got Revolution, Identity, and Conscience are available right now. Go get it. Steve, go get the audiobook so we could talk.
I have like 8 Audible credits. It's on the list. It will be on the list for sure. Yeah.
No, you'll be into this. Just when I was reading this, I was like, oh, this is definitely Steve's, like, you know.
Yeah. And I appreciate you letting me come in on the conversation, because this was more of a tech talk for me. I got to nerd out with an author for a little bit.
Exactly. And I don't mind. I do not mind at all. There was a lot going in to these stories. And so I appreciate that you got to dive into, you know, everybody got something out of it. So, yeah.
So yeah. Everyone buy a copy, take it to the moon.
Yep.
Diamond hands.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. We're going there. Right. Thank you so much, PJ.
No, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Oh,
thank you guys. This was great. What a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Okay. Well, looking forward to seeing what else you have to offer the world as well.
Thank you so much.